This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott, and if we got a great show for you tonight, no, we don't. Damn it, the phone is ringing again. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, east of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You're heading to the Rib Burn Off to check out your favorite retro, still hanging on, 80s nostalgia act live and in the flesh? Well, I hope you have fun. But doesn't it bum you out to see these once multi-platinum, stadium-filling rock bands relegated to summer fairs and rib burn offs? Sometimes you gotta know when to quit. What do you mean it bums you out to see once multi-platinum, record-buying, stadium-filling fans relegated to doing shitty rock and roll podcasts? Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on?
I said,
Working for the Weekend by Loverboy? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be Working for the Weekend by Canadian 80s rockers Loverboy. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line, Mr. Rico Ganu. How the hell are you?
No, hey, man, what's news. New? How are you tonight?
I'm doing well, dude. I'm just, I'm ready to get down to it here.
Outstanding. Well, without further ado, why don't we just jump right in? You knew that they're coming out with a Bon Scott movie, right? I'm assuming you knew about that, like you of all people.
Yeah, I did see that on the interwebs. I saw that it was going to detail his early life, whatever the hell that means.
Well, and see, that you know much more about his life than I do. My question is, I have a couple questions about this. I'm glad we're talking about this, actually. Is there enough about his early life that's interesting enough to tell, first of all?
Does
that make sense?
Yeah, I know. You're looking for some drama, something, some kind of, like, if you talk the Johnny Cash movie, you know, his brother dies at a young age, right? Yeah. There's something, there's some meat on the bone. Yeah. So what I know of Bon Scott was that he was a bit of a delinquent, but he came from a loving family, had siblings, I think a brother and a sister, was in 1960s, like how would you describe it? Almost like Donnie and Marie style bands in the 1960s, one called the Valentines. You can look this up. There's hilarious television footage of him looking.
Ooh, there's footage?
Yeah, of him like wearing a one color velvet, you know, suit, you know, like red velvet suit singing in the Valentines.
Oh my God.
And then he became a hippie and joined a band called Fraternity, which was like a hippie rock band of its era. And then became like even more of a delinquent and a paperboy and a chauffeur, I think, at one point before joining AC/DC.
Okay, so that sounds pretty interesting, which here's interesting enough if you have all of that leading up to the quote unquote, I'm doing quote fingers now, the quote unquote mysterious death, right? And then you would want to leave it hanging at the end of the movie. If I was making this movie, here's what I don't understand, and I'm hoping you can shed some light on this. So the whoever's making the movie basically is saying that it's not a biopic. It's just drawing inspiration from, quote, drawing inspiration from the stories and atmosphere of the time period. Rather than attempting a biopic, the film can offer more imaginative exploration of Scott's character and experiences. But here's the thing that kind of contradicts the first part, unless I'm reading this wrong. Another quote, focusing on his formative years in in Fremantle, I guess that's where he's from. Here's the part. Allows for a deeper dive into the influences and events that shaped him as a person, ultimately led as the iconic. So in the previous paragraph, they said they're just drawing inspiration in a general sense. But in the subsequent paragraph, they said they're doing a deep dive on the influence and events that shaped him as a person. So is it if it's a deep dive, then it's a biopic. If it's not a deep dive and it's just an inspiration, that it's not a biopic. So is it a biopic or isn't a biopic? Why am I not able to wrap my mind around this?
Yeah, you're right. It sounds like they're trying to kind of have it both ways there. I don't know, man. I've read a couple books on Bon Scott. There was an author, Cliff something, who I think did the book Highway to Hell. I own it. Then I can't remember the author's name, Cliff something, or is it Clifford? Can't remember. I think that was the first book written on Bon Scott. Then the most recent one was written by Jesse Fink, and it's called The Last Highway. And it was very controversial because, and honestly, I tend to kind of believe it because it was super thoroughly researched. But I guess I'm saying all this to say that whatever type of movie they're going to make, the reality is the individuals who actually associated with and knew the man have died or are damn near. So you might want to get moving on it, because Jesse Fink, in his book, which came out I think within like the last 5 years, did exhaustive research and interviewed anybody who ever had any contact with Bon Scott back in the 70s. And those people, man, they're shuffling off this mortal coil, as one might say.
In your opinion, it was Bon Scott, what's the word I'm looking for? Was he an interesting enough character? Was he enough of a, did he have enough of a foothold in rock and roll to be able to get away with making a movie, a quote unquote biopic that really is not very factual? Does that make sense? Or because he's kind of an ancillary person, he really kind of is when you think about it, from a certain point of view, does it have to be more accurate in order for it to be interesting? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think you're right. I think as painful as it might be, given that I'm a super fan, I have to acknowledge that what you said is true. He is a footnote in the history of rock and roll. AC/DC had their biggest success without him. And so I think it's a crime. I think he's one of the greatest rock frontmen that ever lived. And I sincerely believe that. But he's not recognized as such for a number of reasons, not the least of which is he died young before the band had big success. So your point is well taken. He is an ancillary character in the history of rock music. So you're asking, is his story enough to carry a biopic, whether it's loosely based or sticking to just the facts, ma'am? I don't know. I mean, the reality to me is that, And I this is going to sound cruel, and I'm a super fan, but when you say you're doing a movie on someone's early years, and maybe it's only because I'm getting older, but when someone dies at 33, aren't they all early years? So,
right.
I don't know that there's enough story there. I think his AC/DC days, you could do a lot about just him being a road pirate and getting away with murder on the road. You could certainly have fun telling that story. Yeah. But is there enough meat on the bone there to really carry a film? I don't know. That's the challenge to the filmmakers. I see what you're getting at. And I probably would say, just from what I've read, I mean, like I said, he seemed to come from a loving kind of normal family. And, you know, he was just, he liked to party when he was in AC/DC, I guess. I don't know that there's enough there.
I guess what I'm trying to say is if there's enough meat on the bone for it to be interesting as a biopic, then it should be a biopic. But if you have to invent things in order to make it interesting enough to make a movie out of it, then you probably shouldn't make the movie, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, I think the story that a fan would want to see is what Jesse Fink touched on in his book, is the dynamic between the band members, where Malcolm ruled the band and everybody did what he said. Angus was the quiet, milk and cookies consuming, no alcohol, complete sober guy, but maniac on stage who just basically did whatever his big brother told him. And then you had Bond, who was the total, how would you word it, Rico? He was just the
outlaw, the pirate.
Yeah, he was an outlaw pirate. And I think at oftentimes, if Jesse Fink is to believed, his behavior was frowned upon by the other guys in the band because they wanted to make it in rock, and they saw him as being potentially a threat to their success if he couldn't keep his act together. So I think that's the dynamic that's interesting, is actually within the band.
That's what I'm getting at. I think the formation of the band, the dynamic between the guys leading up to huge fame, and then it all falls apart when Bon Scott dies, that would be a cool movie.
Yep.
Anyway, let's get to this next one. If anybody actually takes the time, and I hope you all do because it's fantastically done, to listen to Scott's eulogy of rock and roll in between our segments, what you will notice is that in the beginning, he mentions that rock is the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. Well, Scott, we've got a highly anticipated country album coming out 35 minutes ago as of the time of this recording. So Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter, just hit 35 minutes ago. Neither one of us have had a chance to listen to the entire thing. We've listened to Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, right? Those are the two releases. And what I want to know first is, and I you already commented on this earlier, but I think I'm pretty actually... I can't wait to listen to this because, you know, you don't see this kind of crossover very often. I mean, I think the closest thing I could think of, Scott, is when Darius Rucker from Hootie and the Blowfish started doing country music. And I guess maybe the other way around is when Taylor Swift started in country and then transitioned into pop. But I don't remember this kind of transition ever. And I'm kind of feeling the way you are, I think, that I'm really looking forward to this album, right?
Yeah, I've only heard the Texas Hold'em track, and I absolutely love it. I think it's a tremendous track. And I'm really excited because I saw the track listing on Instagram today, and it's got a duet with Willie Nelson on it. It's got she's covering Blackbird by the Beatles. She's covering Dolly Parton, Jolene. And I just think she sounds great. And I don't know. I've read a little bit about it. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not a Beyonce expert, but I've read a little bit about this record. And I guess, I don't know. I'll probably get killed for this because I know she has like Taylor Swift. She's got like super fans, right?
You're right, the Killer Bees.
Yeah, I don't know that any of them listen to our podcast, so I'm probably safe. But
well, they should.
They should. You're right. But I guess she felt like when she was at the Country Music Awards a few years back that she was disrespected there by people, and that this record might be somewhat of a middle finger, because she's going to end up ruling the country music charts.
That's absolutely true.
I think in a big way, and she sounds amazing. And I like country music. I don't like bro country, but I really love classic country. I love Willie. I love Johnny Cash. I love Merle Haggard. I love classic, classic country.
Awesome.
Tammy Wynette. So I'm like, I think this song is so well done that I am excited to hear. I'm legitimately going to listen to the entire record tonight when I lay in bed, and I'm excited to hear it. I'm excited for her. If it's intended to be a middle finger to the CMAs because she felt disrespected, more power to her. One of Johnny Cash's most famous images is that ad he took out with his middle finger up in the air because of the CMAs, where the country music establishment was ignoring him. So, hey, man, I think it's great. Anytime anything can cross-pollinate like that, I think it's a good thing. So I'm all for it, man. I'm actually excited for it.
Me too. And there are plenty of people that maybe have thought about tried crossing over, or maybe have tried crossing over, but for some reason it didn't work out. And what I'm referring to in particular is their singing style. And if you listen to Texas Hold'em, and I listened to the other song too, which is definitely different than 16 Carriages is different than Texas Hold'em, but since you've only heard Texas Hold'em, if you listen to her vocals, like, her vocals are great for old school country music. Like, it's a great match. I think if 2112 was a big middle finger to the label, and look what happened there. Like, when you piss an artist off enough to motivate them to create great art, then that's not a bad thing, to your point. And I'm crazy interested to listen to this album. Blackbird, the duet with Willie Nelson. The more I think about it and the more we talk about it, the more I can't wait to dial this up after we get done recording this, actually.
Yeah, me too, man. And this should be said. I mean, we talk rock here, primarily talk kind of like, meathead rock, a lot of metal, a lot of hard rock. We focus on decades ago for the most part. We mix in some new music, but, you know, Rico's tastes are more eclectic than mine. He's actually a more sophisticated, I think, music fan than I am. I'm a little more down the middle, but I think we both, and I think I could speak with, you know, for you, I think in this regard, is I think we both have a deep appreciation for, you know, artists like Beyonce. I like Katy Perry. I mean, I happen to like a lot of pop music, actually. And so I think we're both, even if it's not necessarily in my wheelhouse and I don't listen to it as much as, I don't know, Iron Maiden or something, it's still a part of my musical kind of palette. And I certainly, even if I don't spin it often, I actually really appreciate these artists. Like in the last year, I've gained just an all new appreciation for Lady Gaga just because of my daughter, you know, and I don't know that I would have that otherwise, but I legitimately like her shit, you know?
She's talented, dude. And I think that kind of goes back, you know, in the 80s, I think I, because we've talked about this before, there was a lot of great pop music in the 80s. And I think, you know, being at that age where you start to appreciate and like music was right when that great era of pop music was, and it gets into your DNA. And so I think that's one of the reasons why people like you and me can absolutely appreciate and love pop music, because of how great it was when we were growing up in the 80s, for sure.
Yeah, it's funny because I was on Instagram looking through her feed the other day, and a young pop star, I don't know who it was, some pretty blonde girl, but she had a t-shirt on, black t-shirt with just white, you know, sans serif print that said, "Hating pop music doesn't make you deep."
That's funny, actually.
I thought that was kind of funny, right?
So cool. Yeah. So I kind of am interested in seeing the Bon Scott movie, and B, I can't fucking wait to dial up Cowboy Carter when we're done here. So having said that, you want to take a quick break?
Let's do it.
Let's do that. When we come back, we're going to talk fucking headbands and leather pants, man. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out, either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host a Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted under the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm. A sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
Hey, thanks for sticking around. We very much appreciate it. Let's make a habit out of this, okay? We're going to be, Scott, you know how much I like Canada, right?
Oh, yeah. You're practically Canadian, dude. I see you just guzzling maple syrup.
At any opportunity, listen, everybody knows how much I like Canada, and it's not just because of Rush. There's a lot of other great things about Canada. I'm talking about you, Scotty, from Van Isle. I hope you're listening to this. Anyway, we're going to be talking another band from Canada tonight, from Vancouver, British Columbia. That's right. We're going to be talking Loverboy. This is Working for the Weekend, off of the very influential album Get Lucky from September 1981, actually co-written by the guitar player Paul Dean. We'll get into all this. Paul Dean, Matt Frenette, Mike Reno finished it off. We'll get into him a little bit later too. Producers Bruce Fairbairn and Paul Dean helped produce this thing. I don't want to waste too much time on this. Oh, one more quick thing. I hope we have time at the end so that I can tell the interesting and unfortunate story about the album cover. Hopefully we have time to talk about that. But in the meantime, Did this song kill rock? I don't fucking know, Scott. That's why we're doing this.
We got to make time for that because I want to hear it, man. Yeah, did it kill rock? I'll tell you what, it did not kill rock for this young lad because back in, what'd you say, 80, 82?
81, my friend.
I was right in the middle. 81.
Yep.
This was, Rico, this was one of the first rock songs I ever liked as a kid. I remember the video. I remember thinking they looked so cool in the leather trousers and the bandana. The hooks.
Oh, my God.
They got me.
Dude, there's so much to talk about. This song has so much discussion value. It's silly, actually.
So it did not kill rock and roll for me at that age. In fact, it was one of the early rock songs I ever have any memory of truly loving. But big picture, Rico, in the big picture, we know rock is dead. We're here to find out if it killed rock and roll.
Right.
By God, you might ask yourself, how do these two men of obvious limited intelligence tackle a subject so daunting and intimidating like the death of rock and roll? There's only one way, Rico, that men of our minuscule intellectual capacity could tackle such a daunting task. We got to cheat. We got to use science.
Dude, we have trouble with sticky ball sacks. How the hell are we going to tackle this? It's crazy.
It's funny you said that. I was adjusting myself as you said it.
great minds think alike.
We use science, of course. Hello. I mean, you know, Bill Nye, the science guy. We know. We've seen these kids growing up, you know.
Or that goofy 70s dude with the bodysuit on with the internal body parts. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. Was it Slim Goodbody?
Is that his name?
I don't know.
That was kind of spooky with that fucking suit with the intestines and heart and veins and shit. Anyway, science, spooky. Right?
Science, of course. That's what we use. We have proprietary science on our side, and it consists of five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. Rico, the band is Loverboy. The song, Working for the Weekend, the album, Get Lucky, the year, 1981. The category is gratuitous boomerism. Rico, how do you score?
This is a hard one, and I'll tell you why. Fine, if you want me to do the 0.5 for gratuitous, for the 0.5 for being boomers, fine, we can do that. Having said that, here's why this is a hard one. This song, I love this song too, and let me tell you, it had been probably maybe never since I listened to this whole album. We're sticking to just this song, but I can't help myself in a few spots here. This song, and really as it represents the entire album, is the national anthem of 80s yuppie America. And if you weren't there when that happened, 80s yuppie America, you're really never going to understand fully what I'm talking about here. If you listen to this song, and we'll get into the particulars about that, and maybe some of the other songs on this album, holy shit, you will know exactly the space that this filled back then. And so, you know what's funny? Any one of these songs, Scott, you know the 80s movie where you've got the hero's journey, where in between act two and three, there's the developmental phase where there's the musical interlude. Any song on this album could be that musical interlude in any one of those 80s movies. That's how important this album is. And that's why it's a very hard one for gratuitous boomerism for me.
Rico, that might have been your best moment on this podcast right there. That is a great, great, great take. You know, it's a one for me too. And yes, the guys in the band are all boomers, so we get that out of the way. But it's not, I would score this a one if they were Gen Z. This is a hard one for all the reasons you stated. And it's funny. I'm going to borrow this from our boy, Martin Popoff. He's got a category, or not really a category, but a way of describing things that he says some things in life And he uses it for music, but I think it really fits culturally in general, really anything. But some things can just fall into the category of you had to be there. And I can only imagine, and that's what you just articulated, was it filled a space at that window in that time that anybody who pulled up this song and listened to it today isn't going to get it. And that's why this band is like playing like your local rib burn off now, because
oh, we'll get to that. Holy mackerel.
You had to be there to understand the role that this music played at that time. And you just articulated it beautifully. I'm just going to close that out. It's a one for me.
One more quick story about that. So at work, the 25-year-old who turned me on to Turnstile, okay, his dad is about our age, and he's like spiritually he's our age because he's listened to a wide variety of music. He watches Columbo on TV, like he's that kind of he's spiritually a Gen Xer, right? So I was explaining to him that sometimes we exchange album ideas, and I said, you got to listen to Get Lucky by Loverboy. I'm going to be talking about it tonight. And I said, before you listen to it, I need to lay a couple things out for you first. And I went and I gave him that spiel that I just gave you about the yuppies and the 80s movies. And he thought that was kind of funny. And he texted me while I was working out, and he's like, I'm so glad you laid that out for me because I love this album way more since you set it up for me like that. So it's hilarious. So yeah, I'm super glad to talk about this.
Love it. Yeah, great take. Let's move on. Category two, excessive misogyny. Loverboy working for the weekend. Enrico, I have the lyrics available if you'd like to hear them.
Nothing would tickle my fancy more than some of your spoken word.
Everyone's watching to see what you will do. Everyone's looking at you. Oh, everyone's wondering, will you come out tonight? Everyone's trying to get it right. Get it right. Everybody's working for the weekend. Everybody wants a new romance. Everybody's going off the deep end. Everybody needs a second chance. Oh, you want a piece of my heart? You better start from the start. You want to be in the show? Come on, baby, let's go. Do you need more lyrics, Rico?
Nah, I think I'm good. Again, this is another one that's had to be there things. You have to understand the landscape of what this is. Okay, little backstory. Paul Dean, the story is Paul Dean was walking down the street in the city. I don't really know what city it was. And it was in the middle of the week, a Wednesday or a Thursday or whatever. And it was kind of dead. It was really quiet. There was really nothing going on. And he kind of put two and two together and was like, yeah, man, everybody's just kind of waiting for the weekend to let her rip, right? And that's kind of the way the things were back then. You got to think, dude, yuppie America was like 30-year-olds in the early to mid 80s. So what? They're boomers who are hitting their peak in the 80s, right? And so they grew up with this work ethic mentality from when they were raised by their greatest generation parents, right? And then you work during the week and you go home and then you save it all up and then you blow it out on the weekends, right? So this song is with regard to misogyny, like those lyrics could be either gender talking about either gender, because in the context of this time period in this group, there was no misogyny here. It was just universal. And again, there's nothing in these lyrics or anything about this that I feel is misogyny. It's not like the debaucherous hairband era that came after it. There's nothing misogynistic about this, in my personal opinion. So it's going to get a zero.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any misogyny here. It's funny because I think Rush, you know, 10 years earlier, did a better job of describing the monotony of the blue-collar workforce in Working Man than this song does. This song is like barely about working for the weekend. If you really read the lyrics, it's, you know, I get it. Everybody's just watching and waiting, but it's pretty, it doesn't really telegraph any kind of meaning. If this guy, you know, was walking through a dead city on a Wednesday and felt inspired to write a song about everybody holding it in all pent up for like Friday night, he didn't really convey that in the lyrics. If I didn't know that backstory and I was reading the lyrics,
I know, right?
I wouldn't get any of that out of that. But I mean, everybody wants a new romance. Everybody's going off the deep end. Everybody needs a second chance. I don't know what any of that is, but
well, everybody wants to hook up at the bar. Everybody wants to go off the deep. Everybody wants to go off the deep end, which means they're going to party their asses off. And we're talking about yuppie America here. So they're all blowing like mountains of coke at the bar. So going off the deep end, I mean, it all makes sense when you put it in context, Scott.
You want a piece of my heart? You better start from the start. You want to be, I guess it is about hooking up to some degree,
right.
but I'm just not seeing the agony of the work week here. I think we needed to somehow, you know, other than just waiting and watching and spend a lot of time deliberating on the fact that we have to wait for these 5 days to pass.
I know.
But Getty Lee did a much better job kind of like tapping into the monotony of the work week.
Do you remember? I think it was more like back then. Am I wrong here? But it feels like back then, like the whole "Thank God It's Friday" thing meant a little more than it does now. And maybe COVID kind of killed that. Does that sound right to you?
Oh, I agree 100%. WMMS here locally, maybe nationally, people still know that station, but they became famous for every Friday night at 5 o'clock. They would play Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. And it was meant to be Born to Run. It's 5. You're in your car. You're heading home for the last commute of the week. And now you're free. You don't even have to go home. You can go straight to the bar. It's Friday, you know? And that was the routine. They'd play the clock out whistle, then kick in the Born to Run. And you knew the weekend was here. So yeah, it was a big deal, man.
They even made a disco movie called Thank God It's Friday. So they even made a movie about the fact of everybody looking forward to blowing it out on Friday night. So I think maybe COVID maybe killed a little bit of that, but it seemed like the whole Thank God It's Friday just was a little bit more impactful back then because of the boomer effect on people like grinding it out during the week and then just saving it all up. I don't know. I could be wrong on that.
I think you're exactly right. That and like, let's face it, the nature of the work week has changed. I don't think with technology being what it is, a lot of people work remote and a lot of times you're never really off work. It's like, I saw a meme on the internet where a young person was wondering like, how did people work before email? You mean when you got off work, you were really off work? And I think that's something else is that like today people are never disconnected from their jobs because of their phone. They're kind of like always on, you know? And so I think it's just a different world. Back then people got off at 5 and it was like, you know, you were done, dude. Let's move on. Category 3. Oh, I'm scoring that a 0 for excessive misogyny. Gotcha. Category 3, wanton whiteness, working for the weekend, Canadians, lover boy. Rico, what say you?
Okay, Canadians, I love you. Canadians, white. This style of music, white. 80s yuppie America, really, really white. So there's nothing but a full one for me out of this one. Absolutely.
Yeah, for all the reasons you've laid out. Yeah, I mean, Canada always gets a 0.5 for whiteness for me, but just across the board, this is as mayonnaise as a rock song can get. But having said that, though, maybe we'll talk about this in culture vulturism a little bit. But I was just going to talk about the song craft that's at work here, but I'll hold it for right now.
All right, sounds good.
I guess, though, image-wise, I guess that's probably appropriate. I remember this being an early MTV video that got played a lot. My family was the first in our block to get MTV, so we were early MTV cable television adopters. So this was one of the early videos I was exposed to, one of the early songs I ever loved. And I remember the band, just the visual of the band, like you said, always with the bandanas folded around the head, the leather trousers, kind of a classic early 80s rock band look. But that early window of, I would say, like 80 to 82, 80, 82 and a half, maybe the first just kissing 83 before hair metal and Image really kicked into being like super important to music. So it's kind of like that weird spot of, you know what it is? This is a Bosom Buddies song. Remember the TV show Bosom Buddies? When you're talking like that around that time, it's like when the 80s were like had one leg in the 70s and one leg in the 80s and hadn't really become the 80s yet that we all think of in memory.
That's exactly it.
This song, even though it's 82, still is in that transition period where the 80s really hadn't become the fluorescent, you know, MTV explosion of color and wild style that we kind of think back on, right?
Right, right, exactly.
This is like the members only jacket era still. It's Bosom Buddies members only era before it really went full, you know, Image.
That's a nice pull. That's a nice pull too, by the way.
But it's certainly a one for whiteness. Let's move on. Malignant Machismo, Working for the Weekend, Loverboy, Rico, what say you?
Headband, check. Leather pants, check. That is, listen, Mike Reno, you get a plus one for boomerism just because of that fucking headband. Let me ask you this. Who owns, Scott, I'm trying to work through this. Who owns that headband more? Mike Reno or Olivia Newton-John with the Let's Get Physical video? Because guess what? That song also came out in September of 1981. So who owns that fucking headband, dude?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And then a couple years later, the headband would navigate from the forehead to around the neck. Remember that was a big deal, like wearing the bandana around the neck? I can remember going to my Aunt Sally's as a boy in the fourth grade wearing a bandana around my neck because Eddie Van Halen did. And so you think how ridiculous I looked as a fourth grader with a red bandana around my neck as I was trying
to be. Wait a minute. Did you have long hair yet?
No, I think I had like an Adam Rich 8 is Enough bowl cut.
Ooh, yikes. So you had the Adam Rich with the Eddie Van Halen like cowboy outlaw bandana thing?
Yes, looking as 80s as I possibly could. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's glorious though.
It is
the only thing that would have done that better is if you would have cut that bowl into a mullet. You would have went into the stratosphere.
That came a few years later, friend.
Yes. Good on you, mate. For me, dude, leather pants and headband alone for me is gonna garner this a plus one.
Yeah, band's name is Loverboy. I think it was, what did I read? That it was inspired by the magazine or an advertisement for CoverGirl. Is that right? I think that's what I read, that they had seen an advertisement and then the joke became like, well, what about Coverboy? And then that just flipped to Loverboy. And so it's just kind of a kind of a name that doesn't age super well today, you know? It's funny because their career and their discography actually goes into the 90s. And it's funny seeing the Loverboy name get the grunge visual aesthetic in the 90s as they desperately try to fit in. It's pretty ridiculous.
Yikes. That's a capital Y on the yikes, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Malignant Machismo.
Oh, tight cutoff sleeve t-shirts, too. Come on.
Yeah, the visual aesthetic for sure. And it doesn't, should we mention how that aesthetic has evolved into 2024, Rico?
Do we want to do that here? I think that's a good spot for that. Speaking of Malignant Machismo, so you go ahead, man. You start this one off.
Well, let's just say, I mean, this you're talking 40 years later, and time is a cruel, cruel mistress, Rico. And
40 pounds later, at least.
You ain't fat. You ain't fat. You ain't fat. You ain't nothing.
I'm not fat. I'm big boned.
Listen, here's the thing. I've thought about this. When you're Mike Reno and you're Loverboy, and you're the national anthem of 80s yuppie America, image means a lot. That time of the 80s, image meant a lot, okay? So you can't roll into these county fair concerts that you're doing looking like a 300-pound biker, still wearing the cut-off sleeve t-shirts, but you have to get them in triple X in order to cover your giant boiler. That's not gonna, gray hair, fine, you're old. That's not a bad thing, but dude, image was just as much a part of your gig as the music was, and dude had a fantastic voice. So yeah. I think he needs, if he want, he could be doing himself a favor if he got his shit together and lost a person's worth of weight and got himself together, because like I said, the image was just as much a part of what made them them. And he's really, dude, help me.
Well, it's hard on your band's image when you're basically relegated to playing rib burn-offs and you're effectively a nostalgia act. True. And if I'm 50 years old, which I am, and I want to go see Loverboy, I'm going for the nostalgia. I'm not going to hear anything new. I just want to hear the hits. And if you look at the stage, and I'm going to borrow from Dee Snider here, and you see someone looking back at you who is showing it a little bit, it only kind of takes you out of the moment, and you need to suspend disbelief a little bit if you're going to fully engage in the nostalgia factor of seeing them, because otherwise you're going to look around and you're going to think, when I was a kid, this was one of the biggest bands in the world, and now here I stand 40 years later and everyone is really out of shape and I'm at a fucking rib burn off and my life is pathetic, and you're going to hate yourself for even being there. So you know, to some degree it is, you know, you might want to, you know, be at your best always.
Now a good example of maybe somebody Mike Reno could emulate is, go with me here for a second, Gary Cherone, right? Gary Cherone 60, right? He's not as old as Mike Reno is, but Gary Cherone is 60, and we saw Extreme, and a 60-year-old Gary Cherone was ridiculously in shape. He looked great on stage. He looked like he did in the 90s, and he was performing like he did in the 90s, and they were able to sell it more. Yeah. I was able to suspend my disbelief more and be more nostalgic and enjoy the show more because the visual was there, and it was just as important as what you go to look at something as well as to listen to something. And I think Gary Cherone maybe is somebody he could kind of look at if he wants to get anything out of the rest of this career of his.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's not a popular take, especially for the music purist out there, those people who are like, well, I only care about the music. Well, you know, people don't go to concerts and close their eyes. I mean, it is show business. Okay, so it is show business. You are putting on a show. You are an act on a stage. I'm going to give it a 0.5 for malignant machismo. Let's move on. Culture vulturism. Working for the weekend, Rico. What say you?
This one's a little tougher for me, maybe a little easier for you. I can't wait to hear what you have to say, by the way. But this song was very of the time period. It was very of the between 80 and 85 time period. It fit right in. Does that mean they were vulturing anybody or appropriating anybody's look or sound? I mean, you could argue that Mike Reno was appropriating Olivia Newton-John's bandana, but they both came out at the same time, so who's to say for sure? But anyway, I have a hard time, especially knowing the space that this song and album took up in that time period culturally and musically. So I kind of have a hard time scoring this one at all, to be perfectly honest with you. So I think I'm just going to do a 0 on this one.
I think when I hear Loverboy, I hear, especially given that we're at 82 here, and this is like what, their second album. If you think back to the 70s, you had like Paul Rogers, right? Which I think him vocally is kind of close to Dean.
Nice pull.
And so you have a band like Bad Company, right? And then you have like Foreigner, I think is kind of close. But this version, this seems like an update on those sounds, right? Take like a Bad Company with that really great kind of FM vocal of a Paul Rodgers, but this feels more brought into the times and updated and given a little bit more like pop kind of sensibility and a little bit more, you know what it is? It's the fact that these guys were surrounded by geniuses. I mean, Bruce Fairburn, I'm not joking. Like, if you look at like the pedigree of the producers they were surrounded with. Bruce, I don't know how to say his last name, but I've seen it my whole life. I don't know if it's pronounced. It's Bruce Fairbairn. It looks like Fairbairn, but I think it's Fairbairn. But
I'm going to say Fairbairn. I'm going to agree with you on that.
But anyway, this guy is one of the most respected producers in the history of rock. And he worked with Loverboy, and at his knee, Bob Rock trained and basically was second banana and trained under Bruce Fairburn. And Bruce went on and did records for Bon Jovi, Aerosmith, and then of course Bob Rock came out from under his tutelage and went on to become one of the biggest producers ever. So this guy was surrounded by this band was surrounded by those two geniuses, which helped make their sound more modern and glossy. And then later on, they would work with Mutt Lange, who had like the Midas touch when it came to production. And so, you know, this is a band that for a band to get big out of Canada, and people aren't even aware that they're a Canadian band. I mean, they got like that big. It was kind of hard for bands to break out of Canada into America, and they got huge in America. And I think it's because they were surrounded by really, really talented producers and songwriters. They wrote their own stuff, but you know, producers always have a hand in sculpting for sound. Sure. And when I hear this song, I hear hook after hook, man. The guitar riffs are hooky. You know, the come on, baby, let's go. That's a hook. The, you know, you want a piece of my heart. That's a hook. Everybody's working. That's a hook. I mean, it's just,
dude, the riff. That chromatic. There's like, there's one thing that grabs you right after another. Yep. It just keeps coming.
And so in a way, this is like proto Def Leppard, where Mutt Lange and Def Leppard are like perfect this come Hysteria, when it's just hook, 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 hook. And you're just getting like sucker punched with like with fucking pop hooks one after it's another. True. Just it's jab, true, hook, jab, hook. I mean, Rico, that's just brilliant songwriting. I mean, that is really, really, really great songwriting. And I'll contend, we talked about pop in the news segment. I think any group of competent, skilled musicians can take a oddball collection of non-fitting riffs and make them fit together somehow and sound like they belong in the same composition. I think competent musicians can do that. And then we all look at that and say, wow, they're amazing. I think what's amazing is coming up. I think what defines great songwriting isn't that ability, but it's rather the ability to write melody and hooks. And this band had it in spades. I'm giving it a zero for culture vulturism.
Totally agree. Well said. I couldn't agree with you more on all of that, actually.
I remember I got into an argument with Dave A once because I said that Bob Dylan is a better songwriter than Metallica. And I said, Orion is not a song. It's a composition. It's an assemblage of riffs and musical ideas.
Yeah.
Very well put together. But like classical music, it's just a composition. I said, Bob Dylan writes songs. And I said, there's a difference to me, you know?
I remember that argument between you guys, the difference between song and music. And I remember that. And yeah, Bob Dylan, much better songwriter than Metallica. For sure. Orion, isn't that their instrumental, right?
Yeah, it's the Master of Puppets.
Yeah, yeah. That's not really an instrumental. It's just it's a song without lyrics.
We have to take this up with DA. Yeah. All right, man. Let's score this thing up. We're running out of time here. Rico, I've got 2.5. Rico, what have you got?
I've got 3.0
for a grand total of
5.5. I'm actually a little surprised. I personally, of course, opinions don't matter here. I personally felt like it would score a little better, but certainly by no means did it kill Rock.
Yeah, not at all. And I agree. I'm surprised the score is a little high, but I think what it comes down to is it might be that you had to be there factor creeping in, because this song is really, really dated. As much as I love it, super dated. And I think ultimately that's where it gets really, where the points added up were in the boomerism and the whiteness and the overall kind of datedness that came back and bit it in the ass.
For sure. Rico,
tell me about this album cover, man.
All right. So the cover, the art director for Columbia Records was named John Berg. John Berg got a deal from somebody this sounds really weird, but he got a deal from somebody he knew, an acquaintance's friend owned a shop, and he got a deal on some leather pants. Okay. So when they were getting ready to shoot the cover, he hired, David Michael Kennedy to shoot the cover, right? And so they sent an assistant out to go find some pants for the photo shoot, right? Well, oddly enough, during this time period in New York, they couldn't find any pants. So the assistant came back with like one pair of leather pants that was too small to fit anybody. So David Michael Kennedy took them home. And when his 13-year-old daughter came home from school, she found the pants and put them on, and they fit her perfectly. She's like, "Dad, I love these pants. Can I keep them?" And he's like, whoa, light bulb moment. So he had the idea, because the pants fit her and nobody else, so that butt that you see on the cover is actually David Michael Kennedy's 13-year-old daughter.
Oh, no. And,
yeah. And they actually hid... you know, they actually didn't let that information out for a while. And the hand is just some hand that there's really nothing be with the hand. It was just a guy that they wanted to have some kind of hand her butt. Right. So yeah, that's David Michael Kennedy's 13-year-old daughter in that photo. Tragically enough, 9 years later at 22, she died in a car accident.
No.
Tragic. So really unusual and tragic story. Interesting with the album cover. So yeah, that's the photographer's 13-year-old daughter on that picture, and not Mike Reno or the guitar player.
Well, and a side note to that, a small factoid that only the hardest of hardcore music fans know, is that Paul Stanley was there getting his hand shot for the cover of The Elder and offered to stand in as the hand for the Loverboy Get Lucky shoot.
Is that true?
So that obviously is Paul Stanley's hand, fresh off of the holding the door knocker on the cover of The Elder.
He put the magic wand and Spellbinder book down to shoot this cover.
Oh my gosh.
Is that true? Is what you just said true?
It's false. I made it up.
Damn it. I wanted it to be true. Shit.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's funny, dude.
You should have lied to me like that cat that's making Bon Scott's movie. Just make up some inspirational story in order to make it more interesting.
I like the 80s too. They're like, just put an ass on the cover. It's like, it's like Get Lucky, Loverboy, put an ass on the cover. Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA, put an ass on the cover. Fucking Balls to the Wall, put balls out. You know what I mean? But anyway, it's just tight shot of private parts. Rolling Stones, Sticky Fingers, not the 80s, but you know, put a zipper on the cover. Put an ass on the cover. Just a close crop shot of private parts is going to be your cover. Black Crowes, Amorica, put a pussy on the cover. Okay. Whatever. Just close.
Chili Peppers, Just fucking stand there naked with socks over your dicks.
Yeah.
Put that on the cover.
Oh my god.
Fucking Jane's Addiction or Porno for Pyros with the cover that those the nude cover of their one album.
Yeah, that was
what the hell's that one?
Ritual De Lo Habitual, I think.
Yeah. That was a thing back then, I guess, right?
It kind of was. Yeah, it was a different time. Different time altogether. But
hence you had to be there.
You had to be there. All right, Rico. Well, sir, I think we've done it again. Surprisingly, we got to the end of another episode. Thank you, sir, for your contributions tonight.
Hey, and thank you as well. I had a lot of fun.
All right. Well, I'm going to go enjoy the Beyonce record.
Me too. Good idea.
All right. Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica. And Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts or visit battleofthebandspod.com.